giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
Hi, everybody. This is the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. It is Friday, September 7th. I am Ben Orenstein, and I'm here with Sean Cribbs. How's it going, Sean?
It's going great. How are you doing, Ben?
Awesome. Doing really well. So I did a bunch of research on your life in preparation for this podcast. And so I just want to lay it out real quick, and you can tell me if I got it right. So you started off studying computer science. Get your BS in computer science. Then we moved on to sort of a bit of a turn. You did some graduate work in music theory and composition, which is completely related to the computer science.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then went on a freelancing streak for a while, a few years of that. Did some work on Radiant, and then ended up at Basho, where you are today, right?
That's correct. One little detour you missed was that while I was in graduate school studying music theory and composition, I spent 3 years working as a choir director at a Gothic style church in downtown Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh, beautiful! Interesting. We'll have to talk about that because I'm a singer as well.
Oh, good.
So it's kind of interesting. I sent an email. I felt like I was kind of interviewing myself this morning. It's like computer science person, Ruby person, musician, but that's actually a surprising amount of overlap in that for whatever reason. Like I sing with our assistant director chorus out in Waltham, Massachusetts, and we have about 60 guys, and I think probably like 38 of them are engineers or programmers of some kind.
Yeah, it's interesting. And a friend of mine from undergrad. The other detour we missed before I talk about him.
Yeah.
Is that I stayed an extra year at University of Tulsa after my CS degree to get a BA in music. Otherwise, it'd be pretty hard to get into graduate school for music theory and composition without like an undergrad degree in it. But to back to my friend, he was a trombone performance major in undergrad, and he ended up doing a master's in computer science and is now a programmer. Funnily enough, like being a trombone player, he was like the last person I expected to become a computer programmer. But there's just a lot of overlap. I don't know if it's people use their one hemisphere of their brain too much in the computer science thing, and they need the balance out, or it's just that the problems that you solve in music and the problems you solve in programming are similar enough that they require a person with multiple talents.
Yeah, so my personal theory is it's something along those lines. So one of the things that attracts me to programming so much is that it is a blend of both sides of the brain to me.
Right.
So you have this aspect of it where you have to be completely rigorously logical because your code has to work in a very logical fashion. But at the same time, you have almost unlimited freedom in how you're designing the thing, right? So there's a creative aspect too. Like, how can I make this code beautiful? How can I make a beautiful solution to this problem?
Right, and sometimes those moments of inspiration that you really need from that creative side help you solve the really hard problems that, once you have that inspiration, you can follow through logically.
Right. And so I think the reason for this overlap of music and programming is you have, I think, the same phenomenon on the music side, which is to play piano wonderfully, you need to have rigorous technical competence where you play every note with the right duration and with the right loudness and all that. But you also have this higher level concern of, am I making music here? Is there an arc of this phrase? Does this sound plaintive? Things like that.
Right. And there's actually been studies of musicians. Specifically, I saw one. It was about an organist. And they did an MRI of his brain while he was playing the organ. And the interesting thing is they saw, or it might have been with a ECG or EEG, anyway. Mm-hmm. But they basically measured the electrical impulses in his brain while he was playing. And they found that large areas of the brain, especially ones that cross the hemispheres, like the corpus callosum, are activated when you're playing music. So you have, you're not only doing the physical motion, whether with your hands or with your breath or both, but you're also listening to what you played and analyzing it,
right?
And also trying to have this creative part of your brain at work, so that you can be expressive and have the music mean something to other people.
Hmm. Awesome, that's good stuff. So you you're quite a frequent speaker.
Yeah, a lot lately.
Yeah.
It was funny. It started about 2 or 3 years ago that I started getting speaking around. I'd done a lot with Ruby for a long time up to that point. And then I started being able to talk at places. Yeah. I don't know what it is. It takes a challenge to get into it, but then once you're into it, you can't get rid of it.
yeah. I'm hopelessly addicted myself.
Right. I love interacting with people and hearing about their projects too. So
totally. So this, we should probably talk about your role at Basho, because that sort of ties in nicely to that.
Sure. Yeah. I'm a software engineer at Basho, which basically means that I can work on whatever projects are available, and whichever projects are, you know, most important to our customers. Historically, I had been working on the Ruby client driver for React. That's how I got into Basho. I started working on it as a contract in January 2010.
Okay.
And then 3 months later, I was on board. I spent quite a bit of time at Basho up until this January, I guess, as a, we now call them client services engineers. So it was like a technical support person. But I was also responsible for doing wide-ranging things as like evangelism and documentation and, you know, going on site to help a customer, also helping them through like, you know, our automated support desk, taking phone calls. But I was also programming on the side. So like now my area of work is much more focused. I'm more on programming and less on the support side.
Okay.
But in the end, we all get involved in what our customers need and want. So, we're all kind of still on that. But one of the things, back to the issue of speaking, one of the things that I started to do early on, and was given the freedom to do, which is wonderful, is to go speak about React, go speak about, using Ruby and React together. And so I've been to a number of conferences in the last 2 years, and probably built up more miles on my frequent flyer account than I care to mention.
Yeah.
But it's been great. And, I think there's a lot of excitement in the industry now, around the topics that we're interested in Basho.
So, your personal site says that you are a developer, evangelist. Is that it? I think so.
Yeah, I probably haven't updated.
Oh, developer advocate.
Yeah, that's what we used to call them.
Okay.
And that was supposed to reflect the wide ranging nature of that, that job.
Yeah.
Now I'm just a software engineer.
Okay.
And I just program.
It's funny, I think if there were a different job for me, like I love being a thoughtbot, I think a developer advocate would be awesome because it sort of mixes like you're writing some code, you're also writing blog posts, you're going to conferences,
right.
You're teaching people, and honestly, that's actually kind of what I do now. It's just
right.
I'm not advocating a specific tool or anything like that, but I love the idea of that position. It's kind of like someone who is rigorously technical, but also is able to teach people and present things in a clear way.
Right, and it's actually been a really competitive advantage, I think, for us, that we have extremely technical people who, you know, if they wanted to one day just, you know, flip the bit over to software engineer instead of, you know, client services engineer, that they could do that without any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that kind of, I said it's a competitive advantage, that kind of really knowledgeable support makes people really happy.
Totally.
You can deliver, you know, the exact solution that they need to fix their problem. You can help them find ways to do something better. You also have a deep understanding of the product because you're not just, you know, in the call center all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? Taking, you know, going through a script of
exactly.
how to support someone.
Exactly.
You're actually thinking hard about their problem and you learn the product deeply. We've been saying it for a long time, but I still believe that, our client services engineers know our product better than our software engineers.
it's interesting. You say that people like it, and on the side of being the guy being supported, it makes such a huge difference. Like I think there are like Heroku and Stripe or other companies that I've worked with where I feel like the person on the other end is like me just working for that other company. Like
right.
They're also a software engineer. They've built Rails apps. They've had problems. And like, we're talking at a very high level because we're almost the same person. And it
Absolutely.
Makes such a huge difference versus when you call, like, I don't know, your health insurance company or something like
right.
that, where clearly the person is, like you said, they're reading from a script more or less.
Right.
Yeah. Huge difference. So we should probably talk a little bit about what React is.
Sure. React
Are
is
you
a...
familiar with it? Have you?
Oh, yeah. No. No, React is a highly scalable, highly available distributed key value store. So what that means is it's a peer-to-peer system. So within the system, there is no master, so there's no single point of failure. It's great for operations. It's great for scalability. because you don't have to rely on the availability of a single node to coordinate things.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a key value store, so it's really got a simple data model. For people who are familiar, it's based roughly on the Amazon Dynamo paper,
mm-hmm.
Which was their system to support shopping carts that were highly available. So you could always add an item to your shopping cart. Even if you couldn't retrieve the previous value of your shopping cart, you could always add a new item. And then, sometime later, the data would come back together. Mm-hmm. And they might have a consistent snapshot of your shopping cart when you go to checkout.
Right. So one of the things that it seemed like was different about React or this type of database is that it's eventually consistent.
Right. And I think it's important to define what you mean by eventually consistent.
Please do.
Yeah. Because there's a temptation to hand wave around that term. But the essential aspect of eventually consistent is that things will converge over time. So if you are just like, well, I'm not going to require all of the replicas of my piece of data to participate. That doesn't mean you're eventually consistent. That just means that you're potentially inconsistent, right?
Mm-hmm.
React includes these are things from the Dynamo paper too, but includes elements of automatic anti-entropy, which we are read repair, which is you try to update stale replicas when you read a value from the key value store, and there's hinted handoff, which means that if one of our replicas is not available, you can write to something that's just a fallback spot, and then later that data will be handed back when the original replica becomes available again.
So can we walk through just sort of an example with that?
Yeah.
So one of the benefits, it seems like to me, is I have a bunch of data and I want to get it in the store. And
right.
I can just basically say, hey, store this data and then kind of go away.
Okay.
Because it's going to be written eventually, right? I'm not waiting for this to get replicated across or...
Well, I distinguish between asynchronous and eventual.
Okay.
So by eventual, I mean that with any ordering of events, of things that you've written to the data store, you will eventually approach the same value in the end. So even if one of them misses, like one of the replicas is not available, eventually you'll get that value through the various mechanisms that the system has.
Okay. The nodes are talking to each other
Right. They're talking to each other, and your application's interaction with it encourages that consistency to be approached.
Hmm. So you said read repair. So what's an example of a read repair? Like how what does that look like?
So like let's say you have a four nodes in a React cluster,
mm-hmm.
and for some reason one of your nodes goes down. Like you had a hardware failure, or somebody who was fat fingered a kill-9 or something.
Yep.
Now you have one quarter of the replicas in your whole cluster unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
For the sake of remaining available, React will say, okay, I can detect that node is not there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to, when I receive a write for a replica that node owns, I'll send it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. Like, so if it's node 4, I'll send it to node 1. And then that means that when node 4 comes back online, node 1 notices, oh, I have this data for you. I don't really own it, but I'm going to send it back to you so that you can get up to date.
Mm.
But what the nice thing about that is that minor failures in a cluster don't mean that your application that's using it is severely affected. So there's a great anecdote from the Postgres team.
Uh-huh.
They deployed a three-node React cluster, one day, one of their developers accidentally shut one of the nodes down.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't even notice.
Nice.
Because the other two nodes were taking over for it.
Yeah.
And their load was shaped such that they didn't notice any drop in throughput or increased latency. So that kind of elastic flexibility mm-hmm. is what's really unique about React.
When I was reading about it, a bit of it reminded me of BitTorrent swarms.
Right. There's a lot of similarities there because BitTorrent relies on a distributed hash table, which is essentially what React is,
mm-hmm.
To find blocks in the file that you're downloading.
Yeah. is distributed hash table easy to explain? I don't have a good grasp on what that means.
Okay. That's just like a hash table that's spread across lots of machines.
Okay. Well, you jerk.
Right. Right. But there, it's even more subtle than that. So Reoc has a concept of a consistent hashing, which says that you basically think of all of the keys that you might store in Reoc as a continuum from zero to a really large number.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of that, you can think of that as laid out along a line, or if you can think of that as an angle around a circle.
Okay.
So Reoc uses a deterministic hashing function. We actually use SHA-1.
Okay.
Which has 160 bits to it, which is a pretty big key space. So every time you make a request to Reoc, it will hash the key you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives it a value that determines what area of that, 160-bit key space to look for that key in.
Hmm.
So that's one aspect of it. The next aspect is that if you think of that as a ring, we actually divide that ring into a fixed number of buckets. We call them partitions.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is allows us to assign those partitions to nodes in your cluster. So a node in your cluster is not going to have a contiguous range of partitions. It's going to have an interrupted range of partitions.
Interesting.
So the next step is the consistent part. Besides just the key always hashes the same place, it's also that the design of consistent hashing is such that you move the minimum amount of information when you add a new node or when you remove a node.
Okay.
So having the partitions rather than just a contiguous key space that we kind of like randomly pick spots in, makes it easier to guarantee that and to reduce the effect, or rather to spread the effect of adding or removing nodes from the cluster, or spread the load of that around.
Right. Because otherwise, if you didn't do this, say you added a new node and then it potentially would have no data copied onto it immediately, right? It could.
Right. And that's actually, I talk about it very, very instantaneously, but it takes a long time.
Sure.
Especially if you've got a lot of data in your cluster for that new node to be ready to serve all of its requests.
Mm-hmm.
So actually what happens is when you add a new node to Reoc, it'll pick a number of partitions that it wants to take from other nodes in the cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll gossip that information around, and the other nodes go, oh, okay, so you own this now. I'm going to start sending it to you.
Mm.
And then once all of the information is sent to the new node that's entering, those old nodes shut down the portion of the partitions that they own, mm-hmm. or used to own, and requests start going to that new node. Now, it's all kind of... That's, again, sounds like too black and white. It's actually gradual. So as soon as the new node has any single partition of data from some other node, it can start serving requests for that.
Sure.
So and it can also serve requests even without taking data. So it can just serve as a coordinator for requests, because that information of the consistent hashing ring is known by all members of the cluster, so they know exactly where to go to find the key on other nodes.
Okay, so one node can help serve the request even though it doesn't have the data.
Right, absolutely.
Okay.
And that's another aspect of the, no single point of failure. You don't have to talk to
right.
any of the by default three nodes that own a specific piece of data to gotcha. Actually perform the request.
So is the default to sort of to then just like trade or just distribute requests evenly among the nodes as they come
right.
in?
Right, right. And it's interesting too, because there are a number of other systems that have a similar architecture to Reoc in this respect. The two big ones that come to mind are Cassandra
mm-hmm.
And Voldemort.
Mm-hmm.
And
those are sort of your competitors, right? Your nemeses,
right.
more or less.
Well, Cassandra has a different data model,
uh-huh.
So that is another aspect of it. But Voldemort is probably the most similar to us in terms of how that works.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Reoc does one thing that those other two don't do, which is automatically select who gets what partitions, who gets what portions of the key space.
Hmm.
And so we've actually spent a lot of time, you know, with some really kind of interesting constraint-solving algorithms to figure out what's the most even distribution of the key space with the minimal number of partition transfers and with the maximum amount of diversity in the distribution of those partitions.
Mm.
So you don't always have like, because, you know, if you think about it, just like striping the key space,
right?
If you had four nodes, it'd be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way around the ring. But that's actually bad because then you have, you don't have diversity among that. So that if a single node goes away, then you have like regular holes in your key space where replicas were. Instead, we try to permute it a bit.
Right.
Of course, that works better when you have lots and lots of nodes because you can have more flexibility in your diversity.
Right.
But that's a unique feature of Reoc that the others don't do, is that we actually automatically assign data to new nodes.
So bringing up adding a new node on there is pretty painless. You just say, hey, yeah, Here's a new node. Go for
it. There's a little command line until you go Reoc admin join, and then the name of another node. And as long as the node you're giving that command is not already part of a cluster,
mm-hmm,
it will join. And then you can see what you can actually in the Reoc 1.2, which just came out last month.
Mm-hmm.
We released a new feature which is a bit more stable careful with how you change cluster membership. So it will actually give you a plan of what's going to change.
Oh, interesting.
So it like calculates the new, and you can join multiple nodes at the same time in a single transaction, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
And look at the plan and say, yeah, that looks okay. I'm not, you know, reshuffling data all the way around. And then you can commit it, and then it just works its way through the transition.
So when a new node is coming in, since there is no master node, it must talk with all the other nodes, and somehow they all come up with a plan of like, okay, here's what we're going to send you.
Actually, that's actually how it used to work. We've kind of moved to there is, you could say it's a single point of failure, but we call it the claimant. Basically, what this means is that only one node in the cluster at any time can be responsible for deciding that transition.
Okay.
But it's not a single point of failure because, first of all, it requires all nodes to be up in order to make a transition. Or you have to, like, from an administrative point of view, specifically say, I'm going to ignore the fact that that node is down,
uh-huh,
and perform the transition. But so it's actually really simple. It's just the lexically first node in the cluster,
mm-hmm,
becomes the claimant, and it all of the transitions of the ownership happen on the claimant.
Gotcha. So I'm not sure we...
I went deep into that, didn't I?
That's cool. No, it's good. This is good. I mean, I'm liking the details. So I'm not sure we got a great description of what it means to work with something that's eventually consistent.
Okay.
So can you try to give me like an example or something that's sort of high level? Like, so I'm used to a database where you want to put some information in, a transaction happens, it either happens or it didn't,
right,
and you know it's in there, or you know it's not. So how does the code I write have to change if I'm working with something that's eventually consistent where maybe it's not in there yet?
Right. You have to assume that nothing is ever atomic. Even requests that seem to fail may have... when I say that, I'm specifically talking about writes.
Mm-hmm.
If they seem to fail, they may still have succeeded. So what you want to do is actually you kind of tend to turn your data inside out. So, you know, relational database, you think about, I'm going to make the tables as fine-grained and independent as possible. We call that normalization, right?
Mm-hmm.
The inverse is true with Reoc and other eventually consistent stores. You want to denormalize. You want to duplicate your data.
Hmm.
More toward the use of thinking, what is the query I'm trying to satisfy? Not what is the, you know, the conceptual structure of my data, but what is the actual task I'm trying to satisfy? And then that means if you've boiled it down to just that task you're trying to satisfy, then you can usually do just key value lookup.
Hmm.
And so it's really efficient. But in terms of eventual consistency, what that means is if you have two rites going on at the same time, or at least they don't even have to necessarily be at the same time, but they have to be oblivious of each other.
Yep. Okay.
That both of those values may show up later as a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
There are different strategies for how to resolve that situation. For example, Cassandra uses a timestamp, and that's like client-specified timestamp to decide which rite wins.
Okay.
And Ryok actually decides with the proper configuration that we're going to keep both values. And then when the next time you request a read for that key, it's going to present both values to you. And you need to make a decision which one is right, or is there some kind of merging of those two values that makes sense.
Whoa.
So it is a greater responsibility on the developer to think about those problems.
Yeah.
Usually people end up, unless they're really certain that the strategy they have to merge those two items is going to converge, you know, it's going to come on the same, approach the same value over time, that they tend to isolate things. So pieces of data that change frequently will tend to be write once.
Okay.
So, like, you write it once, and then if you need that historical value, you go back and look for it. But you don't do as many in-place updates. That is one strategy around it.
So you would create a new version of that object with a new value changed. You don't change, modify the object.
Yeah, and it would actually be a different key.
Different key, okay. Interesting.
Or a key in a different bucket. So actually, React namespaces keys within buckets, so you can like kind of conceptually separate your
okay.
things. But it's just a prefix.
So if I have a user with an email address, I might, rather than edit the user email address on that same key, I would copy the whole thing to a new key with the updated email address.
Well,
and somehow
it depends.
Store that reference somewhere.
So I actually think user profiles are a great use case for React, because you really only have one person editing their profile at any time.
Okay.
So
yeah.
there's low churn on that type of data.
Okay.
But the things that are problematic might be things like event streams,
mm-hmm.
Things that have interdependencies within the data type, like, you know, you need to subtract from one thing and add to another.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of things don't converge or are difficult to converge. And it's actually really fun you bring that up, the thing about eventual consistency, because that's what I was working on in Boston this week.
Oh, great.
Basho team.
Yeah.
For your listeners who are going to be at Strange Loop, I'll be talking about this topic at Strange Loop.
Awesome.
And we'll also, we're putting on a conference, Basho's putting on a conference in San Francisco in October. Called Recon.
Okay.
And we'll also be talking about this. Me and my colleagues will be talking about this there.
Cool. Actually, it's funny you mentioned Strange Loop. That's one of the conferences I would love to get into one day.
It's a phenomenal conference.
Seems awesome.
It's multidisciplinary in terms, at least within, you know, software development.
Right.
And there's lots of people there on the cutting edge.
Yeah. Their thing says their plug is, it's a multidisciplinary conference that aims to bring together developers and thinkers building tomorrow's technology in fields such as emerging languages, alternative databases, concurrency, distributed systems, mobile development, and the web, which is an awesome, like, subset cross section of the world, basically.
Absolutely. And it's where a lot of really exciting things are happening in the industry. So
it's very cool. One little else thing I pulled from their site was, that says the conference is run by a team of St. Louis based friends and developers under Strange Loop LLC, a for profit but not particularly profitable venture. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Alex, who's the primary organizer of that conference, is a really, really great guy. He's been putting on a good conference for the last 3 years. So
cool.
I'm really excited to go back.
Awesome. Have you spoken there before?
Yeah, I spoke there last year. I actually spoke about React's MapReduce system last year.
Okay.
And kind of designing your application to use MapReduce in useful ways.
Hmm.
And part of that was to take the SQL mindset and translate it into the procedural mindset that you need for MapReduce.
Hmm. Interesting. So a couple more things on React before we leave it.
Sure.
I noticed looking at your site. It's an open source project.
Absolutely.
So if you want to use the basic Reac, you can. It's free. You can read the code. Yep. It's totally open source. So you guys, your business model is you have an enterprise version and something called CS, which I'm not sure what that is, but those are paid products.
Yes. Okay. Our enterprise version includes some additional features.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that, you know, people are always like, well, why don't you open source XYZ feature?
Yeah.
But part of it is that the feature that we're providing is a significant value add on top of the open source. And it's also something that really needs the support contract.
Yeah.
So the main feature there is the multi-data center replication. So by default, you tend to put Reac in a single cluster in a single data center, or like if you're on Amazon EC2 or some other cloud, you put it in the same region. But the multi-data centers for higher latency links, where you have less bandwidth too. So, you know, like if you're replicating from United States to Europe or to Singapore or something like that. Yeah.
So that's actually a tricky thing to figure out how to do that well.
Yeah, it is tricky. And I think that, you know, there have been some attempts to kind of build your own. But the problems you have to solve, specifically with networking and with the flow of data within the Reac cluster that is sending replication, is very difficult. And we spend a lot of time on that. So
gotcha. And so you guys also do sort of consulting services as well.
Yeah, we have. You know, it's all negotiable with our customer contracts, but we have professional services as well.
Yeah.
We do provide some custom development services for some of our customers. And we've had some people working with, a large customer of ours for probably a year now, just doing professional services. So along with the support, you can also get, you know, by the hour type of support.
Do you know, and can you share what the breakdown is in terms of, like, are you mostly a software company that consults, or are you like mostly a consulting company that sells?
We prefer to be mostly a software company that consults.
Okay.
I think lately our revenue has been breaking down that way.
Okay. Yeah. Looking at your team page, it looks like you have more engineer team than professional service team by a good factor.
Right. And I don't even know if our team page is up to date. We're probably up to close to 100 employees now.
Okay, it's way out of date then, because you've got 32 people on there.
Well, but not all of them are in engineering, or professional services or client services. So we have a number of salespeople and administrative and the marketing and stuff that don't show up on those pages.
Sure. So it's sort of an interesting business model, mm-hmm. with an open source, your sort of value add around an open source thing.
Right.
It sounds like it's working well.
Yeah. And actually the interesting thing is, open source gets them hooked. And then when they have a real serious deployment and they need the expert support we can provide, which is actually the support has kind of become our hallmark. They're like, oh yeah, well, you know, it gives them a feeling of there's low risk to start, but there's also low risk to continue using it because they can buy support when they need it.
Right, sure.
And they can buy the extra features when they need them. And I think that's really appealing to managers, but also developers, because they're like, oh, I get to use this cool new technology. And my manager's going to be like, oh, they have a stable company with good support behind it. Yeah, I'll sign off on that.
Right, exactly. They have a professional looking website with a lot of people on the page.
Right, right.
Yeah. Awesome. It's almost like the freemium model. But
yes, in some ways it is. But it's more open than the freemium because we're giving away the software.
The free part is actually open source entirely.
Right,
so
right.
You could add on the premium yourself if you were able.
Yeah.
That's cool. So Basho's based in Cambridge.
Right.
But you don't live here.
No. I live in New Jersey, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I've been freelancing before I started at Basho. I've been freelancing for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked from home for a long time. So, most of our team is actually remote. We have office here. We have an office in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
We have one in Cambridge. We have one in Reston, Virginia, and we also just recently opened one in London.
Mm-hmm.
But all of our developers, all of our client services engineers, all of our professional services engineers, they're all remote.
Mm.
And they can choose to go in the office or not, depending on what they want to do.
How do you like that setup?
It's great. I think that it gives that feeling of comfort. You know, you can be in your own home or work from wherever you like.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, more importantly, allows us to recruit the best people.
Right.
So if we don't require them to be in a place or move to a place, then that's not a deterrent for hiring really great people.
Totally. So we're moving more towards having remote people at Thoughtbot. So mm-hmm. for the longest time, we're only in Boston,
right?
And you have to come to Boston.
Right.
We're opening up an office in San Francisco now, a Europe thing as well. And personally, I am struggling a little bit with, there are people that are working in the San Francisco office that I've never met. They're just like
right.
names in a chat room, basically.
Yeah.
So, and I feel, of course, less connected to those people. So in a completely distributed company where maybe you're only going to get together a couple times a year, do you miss any of that? Do you feel
yeah,
experience
we,
that?
Yeah, we do. I think that part of what makes it work is a cultural thing. So since within you know the few months after I started at Basho, we were basically distributed. You know the core group that founded Basho Technologies were here in Cambridge, mm-hmm. which is why we have an office here.
They were Akamai guys.
They were Akamai guys, and there were about six or eight founders.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have an office on Broadway in Cambridge at the ITA building.
Oh.
Now we've got a new office in Central Square.
That's a lot of founders.
Yeah. Well, when I say founders, I mean like the people who were there when I came on, right?
Okay.
But you know, just a few months before I came on, they started hiring people remote, and so there's been for a long time at the company now a culture of being remote. Which means that you interact online through the chat room, through Skype. We actually have a Mumble server now, which is like what people usually use for video game, you know, like live chatting
oh,
during
yeah,
video
yeah.
games.
Sure.
We use it for our daily, you know, Scrum call,
okay.
basically. And then there's you know, just an effort to use email and online documentation to keep up to date. And so it's less like you feel like you need to be in person.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things like, for example, this week when I was up here working with three or four of my colleagues that you kind of have to be in person because you just can't get the same bandwidth.
Right. Absolutely.
And so we do all company meetups 2 to 3 times a year
mm-hmm.
Where all of the employees who are available come to one place. And that's usually where we, you know, do the sort of like company town hall type of stuff. Like, you know, CEO says something about how we're doing business wise. And, you know, each of the heads of department says, here's what my department's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have departmental meetings where we, you know, talk about interesting things that we need to get done or things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we also break out by departments too. So, there's been a tradition, at least for the years that I've been at Basho, that the engineering team will come to one place, and the last 2 times it's been Denver,
mm-hmm.
Since our VP of engineering is in Denver and a number of our developers are there
mm-hmm.
in that area. And we'll do a week of working together on the product and also getting some training at the same time.
Gotcha.
So there are smaller meetups and there's also like the whole company meetup, but mm-hmm. we've been doing that for a while just to get the FaceTime. And there's still people like, you know, especially with how fast we're growing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Somebody forked one of our private projects this morning. I was like, who is this person? And then I go and figure it out. I was like, oh, that's our new hire.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We've been hacked.
I was like, who's taking our private? Oh no, it's a new hire.
So I think personally I would struggle to work remotely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much someone that like, I'm very extroverted. I thrive on sort of interactions with people.
Right.
How does that work for you? I see you have a wedding ring on. I assume you have. You're married
yeah,
to somebody,
right.
So you probably.
Well, it's been convenient for me because my wife is a librarian, her, obviously her job has to be in
person. She doesn't work from home.
Yeah. Right. She can't work from home. So I've, you know, being able to work from home, has been a huge advantage for me, career wise. And it has also been, you know, a huge advantage for us, you know, as a married couple, that we can just move to where she needs to move to.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, while I'd love to live somewhere other than New Jersey, that you know, I have that flexibility.
Right.
And I also don't have to feel like my work is tied to a specific place, even my home. So if there's a day, and actually the spot I am in New Jersey is convenient enough, I can go to Philadelphia or New York, mm-hmm. And come back the same day pretty easily. So if I need to go to Philadelphia, or if I go to New York to go to a meetup or something, yeah. that's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Like it's not going to be like, oh, you know, you came in late today. Are you keeping up on your work?
Sure.
Yeah. There's a lot of trust, that is there for remote workers, and you have to have that trust or it's not going to work.
Do you work out of the house where it's empty? Are you down with that?
Yeah. Well, I tend to be an introvert.
Okay. So you're comfortable with that.
I'm very comfortable with that. Sometimes I look in the mirror and realize, oh my gosh, I haven't shaven in 5 days. this is not looking good, but there's, but on the other hand, it gives me flexibility to work when I want,
sure.
At the pace that I want. And just to feel relaxed. And you know, I've read things lately that they say, studies of companies that have tried remote workers, mm-hmm. Or working from home, that the people who work from home are more focused. They have, they get more work done. They probably work longer than they would if they came into an office. Mm-hmm. You know, there's at least for me, I don't know if it is for other people, but there is that, that stress of commuting, getting ready for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at home, I can be more leisurely about it. I can go to my desk and work for an hour and then go make my breakfast, you know, or I can go downstairs and take my time making coffee and breakfast.
Yep.
And then, you know, go back up to my office. So, or I can take lunch early or late whenever I want. And I only have to worry about, points in time where I have to interact with my coworkers.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So a couple more questions and then we're going to get you on your way back to New Jersey. So I noticed when I Googled, why React, the thing that comes up is a blog post on your personal blog, which is like a 10,000 word opus on
the
glory of
ago.
React that yeah. you wrote before you were at Basho.
It was 6 weeks before I started at Basho.
My question is, did you write that to get hired at Basho?
No, they had already given me the offer.
Oh, okay.
But the, interesting part, which we didn't talk about how I got started at Basho. I met the current engineering team and some of the executives at a little event, in Atlanta in 2009. Called NoSQL East, which is a great event. We really had a blast, and I learned a lot. You know, I'd been kind of hearing about this NoSQL thing. I wanted to check it out, and it was a cheap conference to go to. I was living in North Carolina at the time, so it wasn't that far to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met them there. I was really impressed by the stuff that I'd seen from them. In December, an acquaintance of mine said, hey, you know, I want to use React in my Rails application. But there's really not a really good driver there. I was like, I'll write it, because I was a freelancer at the time. I was looking for new work.
Yeah.
And I was excited by the technology. I was like, I'll write it.
Right.
And then, I got in touch with Justin Sheehy, who's our CTO.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, you know, so-and-so, I should use his name, Tim Dysinger, wants to use React with Ruby. I want to write the driver. Can we work out some sort of like, cooperative contract thing? And we were able to, I became a contractor for a good 6 weeks.
Cool.
Came to Boston for my first time in February of 2010, to work on site in the Basho office in Cambridge. For a week, and then it was around that time that they were ramping up the client services organization, and they said, we need a client services engineer, and you know Ruby, and you're a good programmer, and you know React now. Come on board. And I was like, I think I'm about ready for some real work. You know, 2009 was kind of rough.
Yep.
For a lot of people, it was rough for me too, getting contracts. And I was like, I'm ready for a steady job. And so I started at Basho, and I haven't really looked back.
Interesting. It's interesting that you could sell them on paying you to write the client, which is open source, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and at that time, it was that they're just trying to get eyeballs in front of React.
Sure.
And
like, oh, no, yeah, I think it's a reasonable business case to make to them.
Yeah.
But I think there are people that wouldn't have thought of it, right? Like, oh, right. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be open source too. I'll just go ahead and write it because why not?
Yeah.
But you're like, I also want to get paid.
Well,
I understand. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, and if I get paid for it, then I can justify working on something that's open source and fun.
Yeah, know? Right. You can tell your wife that it's profitable.
It's okay.
And that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you like working in Erlang? That's what React is written in mainly,
yeah,
right?
React is written mainly in Erlang. Of course, there's some C, C++ bits for certain things that are not good to do in Erlang, especially like our storage engines are primarily in C or C++.
Mm-hmm.
I really love Erlang too. And actually, that was another reason why I was drawn to Basho is that I had seen before they announced React in August of 2009, and then I saw them present about it at NoSQL East later in the fall. I had seen some of their Erlang projects, and I was doing some Erlang myself just on the side for fun to try to learn it. I wanted to I've kind of mastered most of Ruby. I want to learn something new. And at the time, you know, some of the prominent people in the Ruby community had said Erlang is the next thing, the next big thing. I was like, okay, I'll try it. I made friends with Kevin Smith, who's done some screencasts for the Pragmatic Programmers on Erlang.
Okay.
And that's really what got me like over the hump into understanding how to do it. Those screencasts, yeah. Mm. Highly recommended.
Cool. We'll link to those.
Excellent. So I've been doing programming in Erlang and being able to understand the code that's inside React has really helped me understand all of the things around it and how it works.
Hmm.
And I really enjoy programming in Erlang. The concept of processes and message passing, and especially the reliability you get from it because you have a crash tolerant philosophy in the way you build Erlang applications.
Yeah. So is that the OTP?
Yeah, that's the OTP thing. So you build a tree of supervisors that watch all the processes that are important in your system.
Right.
And when it crashes, it can go, okay, I can decide whether to restart this or restart all of its siblings or restart them in a specific order or, you know, whichever you like.
It sounded really interesting, this model of the tree where at the leaves you have like a process and then the process is a supervisor and then there's a supervisor of the supervisor and like as far as you need to go, basically.
Right. So you can group your application into subsystems of processes.
Mm-hmm.
And when like a whole subsystem fails, you restart its supervisor and then it rebuilds it from scratch. And the idea that it's better just to throw out bad state than to try to figure out, oh, what went wrong with it and let's fix it and all those things. And you actually, you get reliability because it's able to start from a clean slate.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. That's like part of me, like the purest part of me is like, well, how did you get in that bad state? Why? Like
that's the interesting thing. And what makes both Erlang and React interesting is that you never know what's going to fail. But you build the system such that when there is a failure, you can tolerate it.
Yeah.
And say, it's okay. We'll get back to that. We'll try it again later. We'll restart that process. We'll just wait until that node comes back up. Those sorts of things where you can treat it lazily, but you're proactive about keeping your state clean.
Yeah. It seems very pragmatic.
It is very pragmatic, and it's things break. You want your system to bend, not to break when other things break.
Totally. So one thing I noticed poking around in some of the React code was you have this thing called Dialyzer.
Yes.
And it sounds awesome. So it says it performs static analysis of the code to discover defects, edge cases, and discrepancies between type specifications and the actual implementation.
Yes.
Could you translate that to Ruby-ish.
Okay, so there's a project in Ruby called Laser.
Okay.
Which you may have or may not have heard of.
Haven't heard of it.
But the idea of static analysis is that you can determine at compile time or post-compile time, depending on how your code was compiled, properties of the code. That's what they mean by static analysis. You're not running the code to find out what it does. You're looking at the syntactical and semantic structure of the code to determine what it does.
Okay.
So Dialyzer actually helps us find problems where we have mismatched return values. So you might call a function in some other module, and it specifies its return value a certain way. And then on the other side, when you're trying to do something with that return value, you use the wrong pattern. Then it can Dialyzer can detect that and say, hey, you know, this pattern is never going to match, or the return value, or maybe it's poorly specified. You say you actually put explicit type specifications on your functions, mm-hmm. saying what are the valid parameter values, the valid arguments, and what are the valid return types.
Okay.
And it can figure out within a single function, is it ever going to return one of those return types, or is the argument type too loosely specified or too tightly specified?
Interesting.
So there's a lot of it's traditional language design research and compiler research that goes into this tool, but it helps you find defects in the specification of your interfaces.
Okay, interesting. So before you run it, it does it from
it does
the
it, it does
code.
It from the compiled code.
Interesting. So, does it catch a lot of things? Do you find that it's...
Yeah, it does. There are some things that it's difficult to catch because you might be specifying, a type that is too verbose to specify in the type specification language. So you use a type which is, a more generic type of that. A good example is we have a library that encodes protocol buffers, Google protocol buffers, and Erlang. Well, there's this one function that we needed to implement that would skip. It's reading the binary, the byte stream of values or of the protocol buffers message, and we needed to skip the field that's at the head of the stream.
Okay.
Because we want to ignore it. Well, how do you specify the shape of that stream in such a way that it says this is a protocol buffer's encoded binary stream versus just this is a binary stream. And that we had to leave poorly specified, because otherwise you're writing something where it'd be more like writing it in Haskell, where you define all your types up front and then your functions are really tiny.
Uh-huh.
And where the logic of how to build that is in the type. But in Erlang, it's dynamically typed. It's not statically typed.
Oh.
So it has to deduce from other things what the shape of that type is.
Hmm. Interesting stuff. It's been on my list of things to check out for a while, so I'm eager to dig into those screencasts.
You should. I think that if you've read a bit of Joe Armstrong's book, also from the Pragmatic Programmers.
Which book is that?
Programming Erlang, Software for a Current World.
Okay.
Concurrent World.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the screencasts, and then that'll, at least for me, that was the way I really started to understand it.
Awesome. Cool. So if people wanted to get in touch with you, what's a good way to do that?
I'm on Twitter at Sean Cribbs, SeanCribbs. And I'm also on GitHub as the same handle. And you can send me email, sean@basho.com.
Awesome. And so basho.com is Basho's site.
Yes.
React is on GitHub if you're looking for it.
On GitHub, yep.
Anything else you want to plug while we're here? You got an upcoming talk?
Yeah. So I'm talking at Strange Loop. The title of my talk is Eventually Consistent Data Structures.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be really awesome. It's about data structures that automatically converge without user intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll also be giving a similar talk at Recon, which is a Basho organized conference in San Francisco in October. And last I heard, we have 75 tickets left.
Okay.
Out of about 400. So go and get one now.
Do it. Don't wait. I think that actually wraps things up. Thank you very much, Sean, for coming by. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been great being here. Thanks, Ben.
Cool. So often on the podcast, we'll take some time to answer your questions. If you have something you'd like us to tackle on the air, you can email that question to info@thoughtbot.com or tweet to us at thoughtbot. Today's podcast was recorded by Shauna Quinthal, edited by Edward Lovell, and produced by Chad Pytel. Thank you for listening.